Welcome to Artist Materialist, Episode 10, The Shoddy Statistics of Sports Research. I'm Dan, a material scientist.
And I'm Susanna, an artist and graphic designer.
Today we're discussing an article in 538 called How Shoddy Statistics Found a Home in Sports Research by Christy Ashwanden and Mai Nguyen. And it has a bunch of impressive graphics that were done by L. Koza. So and thank you for agreeing to discuss statistics.
You're welcome. I have to say up front that the lowest grade I got in my entire high school career was on statistics my junior year. So with that caution in mind, I think I can still discuss this even if I don't completely understand statistics. I think I can understand the story in general. Because it's more about science and research than statistics specifically, I think.
Yes, and I've learned the same statistics many times, and I recall it anew each time. And from a material science perspective, a lot of times we're doing more of the statistical mechanics, which is a different kind of statistics than this kind of statistics, which is more about the scientific method. So with all of that said, the main thrust of the article is talking about the controversy surrounding magnitude-based inference, or MBI, which is a statistical method that has been used extensively by Will Hopkins, who's a physiologist in New Zealand, and the enthusiasts of this method, Will Hopkins chief among them, say that it is a blend of Bayesian and non-Bayesian statistics of statistical thinking, which lets you tease out real effects from smaller sample sizes, which is important. Specifically, the article talks about if you're doing some sort of sports test, some sort of sports experiment where you need to bring in elite and monitor everything about them, you're not going to find that many athletes that are willing or able to do that who are also elite. So you are limited by how many people you can get to do these things, you know, and test. Does it matter if you use sports drink versus water, or does it matter if you do some other thing to improve performance?
Yeah. And the difference is that, as it's explained here, that the traditional method, which is called, let's see if I can get this correct, it's the NHST.
ANOVA?
NHST is the
NHST,
yes,
okay.
Which is the traditional statistical analysis method. And the difference, as they explain it, is that the traditional method has fewer false positives, but more false negatives. The MBI method has fewer false negatives, but more false positives. So basically, the MBI method is more likely to tell you that something works when it really doesn't. And the NHST is more likely to tell you that something doesn't work when it actually does. But if you look at their excellent graphic explaining how both of those methods work, when it all washes out, the NHST is overall more accurate, whereas the MBI looks to be more inaccurate than accurate most of the time. It has so many false positives, or is likely to have so many false positives, that the fact that it has fewer false negatives doesn't really help it in terms of accuracy. Does that sound right?
Yes. And you can see how, on the one hand, if you're coming from a perspective of I'm in sports science, I'm looking for every little edge, including just the ones that haven't been found yet, which are probably going to be these minor little tweaks, and I just want to see if anything even might work. because if nothing else, the placebo effect is probably pretty good, then maybe you are willing to take all these false positives to find something that other people have discarded in case it actually is real. And on the other hand, from a more traditional science perspective, you'd much rather assume that something doesn't matter than to falsely claim that it does. It's the scientific skepticism is such a bedrock of traditional science.
Yes. And I feel like I actually know something about this, what they're talking about here, this research, because for several years, I worked as a web designer and graphic designer for several different research departments at a university, and everything from biology to environmental science to, for a while, I worked for the exercise science department. Specifically, I worked for the Children's Physical Activity Research Group, which researched the effects of physical activity on children. And but I had exposure to other parts of the exercise science department, and maintaining their website, I got to see a lot of the papers that they published and things like that. And I am sympathetic to the idea that it is hard to find enough test subjects. I mean, anything, the whole school of public health has that problem. It's hard, very hard to get human subjects who are willing and able to participate in your study of elderly people with diabetes or whatever it is that you're testing. But I feel like also there are very good reasons why there are floors for the number of people that make a valid study. And not to say that you can't do a study with a very small number of people. You certainly can, and you can follow the scientific method. It's just that your results are going to be taken into question. And instead of saying that you've discovered something new, it might be that, well, you've discovered something that might spur further research.
Yeah. And what goes with that is my experience in research has included a number of areas where each time you try to take one measurement, just getting one number will take a whole week to potentially get one number. And so the idea that you do that several times and you go through all sorts of trials and tribulations and you spend thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, and the result is, that being the end of the story, I that's very unsatisfying. And I can see how from a you know, the 10,000 foot view of, well, you know, the proper statistic says just ignore it. You didn't find anything, suck it up and move on. The other perspective is, well, but we did all this observations, we looked at all these things, we recorded all these things, can't we get something out of it? And then the question is, what's the right thing to get out of all of that? And I think you should always be able to find something. If nothing else, you should be able to identify method tweaks that would, or learnings about how you were taking readings or and whatnot and so forth. So there should always at least be some sort of methodological learnings. But the controversy here is, well, are you just trying to say, well, we didn't find anything significant, so we'll just say that it's possibly significant, and that's kind of fudging with the rules of the game, and in a way that maybe you can't really do.
I tend to agree with you there. Married to a physicist, and back when he was in grad school and we were dating, he was working with a huge consortium of people who were trying to determine the mass of the neutrino. That was in the news a while ago while they were working on that. And talk about something that's extremely expensive and hard to measure. You know, there were numerous experiments that were run and, you know, cost a lot of money and millions of dollars in these huge facilities, and came up with inconclusive information. And part of the way that it was done is nobody really was sure exactly what the best way to detect neutrinos was. And that's still something that's a little up in the air because everybody has created their different detectors and methods, and some say one is better, and some say another is better. But even so, there is sort of a generally accepted group of detectors that you can say, okay, these ones have had some pretty good results. However, there was one particular researcher who I remember I heard a lot of complaints about from a university. I don't remember exactly what country he was in, but he thought his detector was best. And the general consensus was his results had too much noise and he wasn't really getting good information. And he was very indignant about that. And he did exactly what what Hopkins, who created this different method of statistical analysis, is described as doing here, which is go to a different scientific journal and rebut that position, which is, you know, what you're supposed to do, say, rebut them and say, no, I really am right, and here's why. And
yeah.
And then, of course, the other people come back in a different journal and say, well, no, you're really not right, and here's why. And eventually you would expect that this is science, the truth would win out. But when you have someone who has a very strong personality and is determined to be right, they will go and sort of build a coalition around themselves. That's what this researcher did, is he was so sure that his detector was the best and that everyone was just giving him a hard time for no good reason because they didn't like him. And he tried to build a coalition to show that his detector was the best, and it was really the best, and everyone who said otherwise was lying and not looking at the information correctly, and it just ended up discrediting him more. And I have to wonder.
That's in all areas of science, and part of it has to do with, if you're going to be so focused on a single topic that you're really willing to devote your life and write grants and all of that, then you are likely to be someone who has some stick-with-itness. But that happens in areas of science, and I've certainly encountered that in the areas of research that I've been involved in. And sure, you have different camps, and one camp says that things happen this way, and one camp says that things happen that way, and maybe advocates from one camp happen to be tapped to be on the grant writing panel for the NSF. And so that if they're a gatekeeper in that way, then maybe they denigrate the ones that come from the other camp. And so then the research goes in one direction, and all sorts of things can happen. And there's a sense in, it seems like all areas of research and academia even, that the way that things change is not that people change their mind, but the previous generation retires and goes away, and then the new generation comes up, and they may have heard some of the details of the controversy, but they didn't know all the details, and so they just, it allows the new ideas to become more prominent.
Yep, they can look at things more objectively without personalities getting in the way.
Until they get their own thing and latch on to their own interpretation, and then it'll take another generation for that to go away. So I don't think anybody has a better claim to objectivity necessarily, but each generation has their own hang-ups.
Yes, there's no cure for human nature.
Yeah.
And that's something that is mentioned here in this article, is that this guy, he is part of an older generation, and he has devoted his whole life to this particular statistical analysis method, and he's teaching it, and, you know, he has sort of these acolytes who are following his method, but as some of the younger people coming up who maybe aren't part of his following are noticing, people don't really seem to be able to explain how it works or really understand it, and that makes it suspect in the realm of science.
The other, going back to physics, you know, there's the debate that this article that we're discussing talks about, is this sort of the magic number of p equals 0.05, of the 5% probability that of that something could be happening by chance. And as opposed to in physics, because they're like, we want a definitive answer, they add several more zeros between the point and the five or whatever. So they're looking for, instead of what, 5 chances out of 100, they're looking for more like 1 chance out of 1 million or 1 billion. That's a whole, they're willing to throw away a lot more stuff, but presumably they can see, because they're trying to find an answer that they can repeat over and over and over, they can in a certain sense test their detectors by seeing whether or not they get close to the right answer, because they know, they already kind of know the answer. They sort of know the mass of the neutrino, it has to be between X and Y. So they can see, oh, does our detector give us that, yes or no? Whereas with a lot of these sports things, you're measuring people who, you know, everybody is different. And so under the best scenario, you're still going to get a lot of variation just because every person is different. And we have all of our own unique DNA and mutations, so we're all going to react to things a little bit differently. So the absolute best test that involves people is going to be a lot, fall a lot short of what you get in physics.
Yes. And all the same, though, it just depends on getting better research and better research tools, I think, in sports medicine. And the reason I say that is because, again, working for the Children's Physical Activity Research Group, part of what they did was they created what they call instruments, which are ways of measuring either observed or self-reported physical activity that are accurate. And through their research, for example, doing a study of activity in adolescent girls or walking in middle school students, they create this tool to measure how it works, and then they see how useful it is in research, and then they refine it and repeat the study and continually refine their tools and eventually come up with something that they said, yes, this got us very accurate information, and it didn't get us a lot of noise. And this is a good measuring tool for research studies, so we can use this in the future. But it takes years to come up with something like that, and it takes a lot of work, and you know, it takes some throwing away of data that was hard won. And I know that, again, when you're, the people I worked with were working with a lot of them, either children or elderly people. So there was not so much a dearth of subjects. It was just a matter of finding people willing to do it. There are plenty of, you know, plenty of middle schoolers out there. They weren't as specialized as, you know, having to do people who are elite yeah. athletes. Even so, though, I think it's incumbent on the researchers to come up with better tools and better measurements if the ones that you have don't seem to be doing the job.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a name that did not come up in this article, and one reason I kind of liked this one as to discuss these topics, is that so there's been a lot of interviews and articles about the Reproducibility Project, which is headed by Brian Nosek. And that is this giant movement in psychology where a team of 100 psychologists got together and they tried to replicate 100 papers that had been published in psychological research and had been cited highly. And so they tried to reproduce them and they failed to reproduce a lot of them.
I remember hearing about that. Yes, it was quite surprising because some of the things that they tried to reproduce were very famous experiments that people had sort of taken as gospel over the years.
Right. So, and that really ties into the questions here about when they reproduced them, were they getting false negatives on these prior papers, or were the prior papers themselves false positives, and now they were showing that they weren't necessarily true? And then you get into all the details of, well, did they reproduce the experiment right? What were the relevant details and how they did their experiments that were important and all these things. And the Reproducibility Project really tried to work with the original authors and all these things. And so this is an ongoing effort and has really led to a new trend in pre-registering experiments where you, because of the publisher-perish model, that you there's a strong drive to only publish positive results. And so this new pre-registration movement is where you say ahead of time, this is what I'm going to test. This is what I think is going to happen. And a journal agrees ahead of time, okay, we will publish your results, whether or not you get a positive or negative result, as long as you do what you say you were going to do.
That's a very good point. Mm-hmm. It is, it's some people's careers on the line about whether or not they get published. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you would know this better than I would at this point, how much does it matter nowadays with the proliferation of reputable online journals? Does it matter as much that you get published in a specific journal, or is it easier maybe to publish negative results with in a lesser journal?
So there's a couple of complicated things in there. I would say that the movement is towards open access. The country of Sweden just announced that they would no longer license Elsevier, which is one of the biggest databases of journals. So there's a real movement towards open access. There's a huge movement towards preprints, which have been in physics for a long time. The archive, that's been around for a long time. And now it's popping up in other areas. There's the bioarchive and the chem archive and some sort of psych archive. And those are all more databases where you publish a draft. And so people can comment on those. But from the perspective of the professional development, it really, really matters where you get published. If you put something on archive, maybe that matters in physics, but the other areas, you really have to be published in journals, and it matters a lot which journal you're in.
Okay.
Matters a lot. So there's the old thing, if CNS, Cell, Nature, Science, if you have, you know, one CNS paper, that might be enough to get you hired as a assistant professor, whereas you could have a whole bunch of things in something with no name and it won't matter.
One thing that I do remember from the time working for CPARG too was when I was updating their website and also the National Physical Activity Plan website and updating the lists of publications, the names of some of these publications, there were so many that I'd never heard of. It was amazing, which is why I asked that question, because it just seems like there are so many, such a wide variety of publications out there. But I guess within each field, it really matters. So while you might not have heard of Exercise Science Quarterly or the Journal of Obesity, those sound obscure to you and I, but to the people in the field, those are really important.
Yeah, the literature can be really divided. There's a whole thing about how it took an extra 50 years for the neuroscience community to accept that DNA existed, just because it hadn't been published in their journal. So they were like, no, it's not a thing yet.
Wow. One thing that this article mentions, going back to what you were talking about, psychology, says that at the end of this article, it talks about how sports scientists who have small sample sizes could improve their research by pooling their resources. And it mentions that psychology mm-hmm. researchers have done that because, again, it is hard to find subjects for very specific psychology research, especially if you're researching people who might have an unusual psychological issue. And that's something that really does make sense to me. I mean, especially with how connected the world is, I know it was mm-hmm. harder in the past for someone in China to collaborate with someone in Israel and somebody in San Francisco, but nowadays that's a lot easier. And it seems like that would be a really good solution to dealing with small sample sizes.
Yeah, there's an ongoing thing in all areas of science, and I don't it's still mystifying to me how it exactly works in physics, where you have these, as you mentioned before, these giant teams working on things, but there's a real tension between how difficult and expensive it is to generate experimental data, especially medical data, and on the other hand, how many citations you can get writing meta-analysis and review articles.
So explain
And
that
that's
more. What do you mean by how many citations you can get?
so that's sort of how it's so citations are kind of the currency of academic papers. So it's not how many books you sell, because everything is living in these journals historically. Now we might go to like download count might start to matter, and maybe that's a solution. But historically, whether or not you had a paper that was really important, one way to measure that was how many times have other researchers cited your paper in their paper.
Okay, that's something that is mentioned in this article where they said there were about, what, 2,500 citations of the original MBI article explaining this
Right.
method. So that shows that it was maybe a very good, that's a way of determining that it's probably a good thing because so many people cited it.
Or at least
It's important.
important.
Okay.
And so that's another way, other than, so you can either publish in a great journal, and the way that you determine what a great journal is how many average, what's the average number of citations that an article in that journal gets. Or you could still be considered to have a great paper if it was published in a lesser journal, if it the article still got a lot of citations.
Okay, so the problem then with having collaborations working on stuff is that it might not get as many citations because everybody in the field or half the people in the field are all working on the same project.
Well, what happens is it's sort of the chain gets broken. So if you spend, hundreds of thousands of dollars putting people in an MRI, and you did that for your elite athletes or whatever, and that data got nicely chopped up and presented in some sort of meta-analysis of somebody who didn't have any experimental lab at all, they took 10 such 10 experiments of people who had used MRI machines, and they gathered all that data together and they put it up nicely and presented their results. And so they actually get, oh, my statistical analysis are stronger, and so this is what I found. And then if somebody comes by and does a literature review to try to summarize the state of the field and all of the things that are happening in it, they might just cite the meta-analysis of all the one that nicely summarized the statistics of each individual experiment, and they might not cite the underlying papers.
I see. Okay. Well, that's slightly different than how the physics collaboration or another collaboration that I personally worked with worked. They have the group of researchers who work together and they don't publish, they publish as a group after they get their data. So they pool their data, then publish, as opposed to
Right.
waiting for somebody else to do it. A meta-analysis of their separate papers. And that's also when I worked
Yeah.
with the Ocean Studies group, because we were getting data from buoys off the southeastern coast. That's again, it's hard to put those things out there with all the scientific
Right.
instruments on them. It's expensive. And each research group can only afford time and money-wise to do so many. So what we did was we had several educational institutions all along the southeastern coast band together, and each one put out four or five buoys, and then we got our research, got our data from them and published it all together as one big project. So
Right, and that's and then on the other what happens then though is that the people who are in very under-resourced institutions say, hey, you're not letting the data be free. Why are you hoarding it for yourselves? And you're like, well, we gathered together and we took the data, so we want to analyze it ourselves because that's the part where you discover something. And then you have, on the other hand, people, well, but data wants to be free. Why, you know, the public paid for this. Why aren't you sharing it with everyone? So that's where that's the friction in at that point in research.
Yeah, I can see that. And the way that they solved it in this particular collaboration was by having some PIs, principal investigators, who ruled the group very strongly and said, this is the way we're going to do it. And they were spread out across the different groups, but they were the people who brought in the most grant money, and they said, this is the way it's going to be. And everybody kind of agreed, and that's how the data was processed.
Right. Well, everyone within that community. And so you can see how somebody might come along later and say, well, okay, I see you had your buoys on the Southeast Coast, and here's another study that was done in the Pacific, and here's done one that was done off the coast of Europe. And I'm going to take all these things together and put a nice bow on them. Hey, why aren't you telling me what your underlying data are?
Yeah, that's true. There is a desire to really protect the data because that is, I mean, that's their gold. That's their money, is the data. They're very willing to publish the what would be the word, where you've already processed the data, but the raw data you're never going to see. That's part of the researchers. They own that, and they are going to hold on to that. And part of the reason that they won't share that is because they'll say, well, you know, we haven't, if you get the raw data, you can get bad information from it, because if you don't understand how the research is done, if you don't know all the details about it, you won't understand it properly. So it's bad science to share the data freely like that, the raw data. You can only have the data after we've looked at it.
And so that, and that going back to the article, you have this, you know, the extreme skepticism that they have, like, well, to use this MBI method, you put some things into an Excel spreadsheet and it spits out numbers, and we don't know what's underneath that. Like, well, if you don't know what's going on, you do it wrong. It's like, well, but we don't trust that you're doing it right.
Yes. So
So.
to wrap this up, do you have any final conclusions?
So we talked about replication and that, and the other sort of point that I did want to make was that this is published in 538, and one of the charges made against this MBI method is that it tries to halfway go towards Bayesian thinking. And Nate Silver, who founded 538, has a whole book called The Signal and the Noise about Bayesian versus frequentist analysis. So it's I think it's very interesting that they have this discussion ongoing, and I think it's one that continues to affect all of us in a very science-driven world.
I think that's a good point. Want to keep our eyes on what how they're getting their information, and what the implications of that are.
Yeah, we all have to be consumers of what is told to us is the truth, and how to be critical about that.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode. You can find the Artist Materialist podcast on anchor.fm/artistmaterialist or wherever you get your podcasts from. And you can also find links to the articles we've referenced and make comments on our blog at artistmaterialist.wordpress.com.